I feel like there is a more acceptance to attack Muslims than it would be for, let's say, Catholics or Jewish people.
Really?
I feel like there is a more acceptance that society has created with, you know, with 9/11 and the narrative around terrorism and things like that, that it's become a lot more acceptable to frame Muslims as extreme, as their religion being extreme, than it is for other religions. I think currently that's what we're really, I think that's where we are right now in terms of, yes, it might be something that's in within all three religions, but I feel like it's accepted now within society that you can be Islamophobic and you won't be challenged on it. So,
well, for more on this subject, we've also been able to speak to the veteran journalist Yvonne Ridley, who is currently a national executive member of the ALBA party, which is a Scottish nationalist and pro-independence party.
Humza Yousaf has boxed himself into a corner at the moment on mixed marriage, and you have to wonder, well, he's sounding more like a career politician than a conviction politician. Whereas one of his rivals for the First Minister leadership is Kate Forbes, who is a committed Christian, but she's obviously, looking at her background, more of a conviction politician. She has come out, drawn her red lines. I will do this, I believe in this, but I will not agree to certain issues. At the end of the day, all of these politicians, regardless of whatever faith they hold, they are representing a mixed community, people of faith and people of no faith. And so in order to represent them fairly, they can't afford to have too many red lines that are going to upset certain religious or even non-religious sensibilities. Some people might think that Muslims are on a hiding to nothing because if they embrace the fortitude of Kate Forbes, who was quite adamant about her religious position on legislation, their critics would say, oh, this is Islamism coming into it. This politician is a fundamentalist, he's an extremist, he's dangerous. And of course, we all know in Britain that Islamophobia really is a very long word for racism. And unfortunately, we know that Britain, especially in the establishment, is institutionally racist. It's just there. So politicians from the Islamic faith, especially olive-skinned politicians, wouldn't be given the same latitude that Kate Forbes has been given. In fact, her rather obstinate position, non-negotiable position on same-sex marriages, has earned her a lot of respect, because she has stood by her guns. So it may be that her position to refuse to compromise anything that would affect her faith may actually serve her well in the end, because people do like politicians who are decisive. The danger is that Muslims will not engage, will withdraw into an Islamic bubble and not get involved in politics. And that is the last thing that we want to see. I have lived in Scotland now for more than 10 years and can see the difference between the Scottish communities and the English communities, Muslim communities. And the Scottish Muslims are very happy to wave the Scottish saltire, the blue and white flag, and celebrate the famous poet Robbie Burns, and celebrate St. Andrew's Day, which is the patron saint of Scotland. And they seem quite relaxed and able to do that. And, you know, Hamza Yousaf, when he took his parliamentary oath, he swore on the Holy Quran while other ministers swore on the Bible. He swore on the Holy Quran. He was wearing a kilt in Islamic tartan. We have our own tartan in Scotland. And that message is so powerful. And what the message is saying is anyone, regardless of faith or skin colour, can take part in government. And this trickles down to kids who are looking up at these politicians and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Not just Muslims, Jews as well. Yeah. More than 40 Jewish Labour members have been, they've said, persecuted and hounded out of the party. Because since Keir Starmer arrived, we've now learned that there are two sets of Jews. There are good Jews who support Israel and are Zionists and are proud to say that they're Zionists. And then there are bad Jews who don't believe in Israel, are very hostile to human rights, abuses in Israel. And of course, they're perceived to be bad Jews and have been thrown out of the party. With the exception, I think, of one who's decided to take legal action, and the Labour Party has apologised.
Well, before we continue the studio discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this. We spoke to two Muslims to give their issues on this particular subject.
Politicians like Sadiq Khan, who were elected on a basis that were Muslim, should not go and compromise on their religion. I feel like if you're being elected on the basis of being a Muslim and you're representing a certain group of society, you shouldn't go against what they elected you on. And as a person who studies politics, it comes with democracy and representation as well. You're voted on a basis that people believe you're the person to put their ideas across, and once you start going against them, you shouldn't be in power.
Hi, everyone. My name is Itisham Salamikum. I'm a councillor for this area, so I'm at Wembley Hill. In the 5 years that I have been elected, I haven't actually been put into a position where I've had to compromise my principles. But not because of anything else other than we are believers in justice and equality, freedom and principles of empathy and compassion. The issue that's going on there, and I have differences, let's say. I'm trying to be diplomatic with those who have a stance on particularly the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is not right, I'll be honest. Our religion tells us not to kind of judge other people, but obviously in particular instances where we can have disagreements with them and we can have conversations, and I think that should be where we are allowed to have kind of differences of opinion, but at least we should have that conversation. If we stifle debate, then that is the point where they've already lost. If they want to stifle debate on certain issues and they're not open to having those conversations, then it shows like a lack of moral strength or intellectual integrity.
What about Baroness Wazi? Someone like her, did she compromise on her Islamic principles to remain in politics?
Irrespective of whichever party you are from, you need to make sure you don't compromise on your principles. And I know that she has done a lot trying to highlight the levels of Islamophobia that are present, again, not just within the Conservative Party, but across this country. We are still a racist, sexist, misogynistic kind of country, an old imperial, colonial kind of country. We still have the remnants of that. So in terms of what she has doing, it's positive that she is highlighting it. But if she's the lone voice, and let's be honest, the Tory party are so right-wing now that they are painting Muslims as the enemy. If she is a lone voice in that battle, then she can only do so much. Again, I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I don't agree with a lot of what, again, she stands, she's a member of a party that I totally and vehemently disagree with. But in terms of her as a person, as an individual, if she is the only person that's doing it...
Well, there you have it. Plenty of views we've heard on this issue now. Now, obviously, the LGBT issue in Scotland is not the only example of where Muslims have entered into politics in the West, and it appears as if they've had to compromise from one degree or another. Other areas would be, say, on the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause. It seems like London Mayor Sadiq Khan has expressed a great interest in going to visit Israel, for example, and is very happy to do so, in his view. Ilhan Omar in the US, a Muslim senator, has voted for resolutions which are branded as pro-Israel as well, and also support for Western wars, that type of thing. So just tell me where you stand on this, Lubaba, because obviously I think most Muslims, if not all, would say that these are red line issues. We shouldn't be compromising on Palestine and other issues.
So in context, my mother is Palestinian, so Palestine is something I will never compromise on. I can't, because that is my identity. One thing I will never understand is when someone compromises on seeing the oppressed, because we know in Islam it is our responsibility as an ummah, as a community, to stand on the side of the oppressed. And that should not be controversial. That shouldn't be something that is striving debate or what did the guy say that the previous on the video where, you know, having to be diplomatic about it. Personally, I don't think we do, not on something like Palestine, especially in something like Palestine, something that's happening right now in China with the Uyghur Muslims. Syria is another example. These are issues that, no, we don't need to be diplomatic about. We should be very clear that we will stand on the side of the people that are constantly being murdered on a daily basis, that their land is being taken away from. And that's what Islam tells us to do as well. And so I get very agitated, I get frustrated, obviously as a Muslim, but I think it's mainly as a Palestinian, when I see that people get elected on the oppression of my people and then they get elected and they throw it all away. And to be fair, this is not something that I've just seen among Muslims. You see it among the white left as well, that will talk about Palestine, will be openly talk about it, but then as soon as they get into their positions, they forget about it all. And so, yeah.
Do you think then, in that case, that there is an issue here? Because, as you said, when Muslims get into politics, not talking about yourself here, but other candidates, when they get high-ranking levels in politics, they are expected to compromise on this. To be pro-Palestine, as we saw with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, can get you in a lot of hot water. So they may opt to go for a more mainstream opinion on it, which is to be impartial, if not basically pro-Israel on the subject.
Then what's the point of being what's the point of going up in ranks? What is the point? Then that's the question we have to ask ourselves then. Should we be encouraging Muslim representation in politics, in positions, to get them in positions of power, like, for example, Sadiq Khan as the current mayor, if that will not benefit us in any way or form and it then leads to compromise, then genuinely, and it's a question that I feel like we do need to ask ourselves, that should we be asking for that representation? Because is it not worse then? Because then what happens is that you have Muslims who are in positions of these positions of power, you could say, who've compromised on their views. And then there's an expectation now for any Muslim who decides to go into those positions of power to also compromise. So then the question really is, what's the point?
It
sounds very harsh, but that's the question we have to ask ourselves. Then is there a point in encouraging Muslim representation in the current political sphere that we're in?
Do you think that we actually have Muslim representation at the moment?
No, I actually, and again, this is, I actually believe we have socialist representation who just happen to be Muslim, who just happen to be people of colour. But I think it's a very pick and choose for a lot of Muslims. Like, I understand me, and, you know, the one thing we are taught in Islam is not to assume what a person's going through.
Yeah.
But I do recognise they are under a lot of pressure, an enormous amount of pressure. I do recognise that. But at the same time, it really depends on the individual. If they were elected on the basis that they were Muslim before their politics, then you have an expectation and you have a responsibility to represent being a Muslim in its whole, and you can't pick and choose when to give things up and when to, you know, do that. But if you were elected on socialist policies or Tory policies or whatever it is, but then you just happen to be Muslim, then that's a different ball game altogether in terms of that discussion. But when you, and I think that's where the conversation with Sadiq Khan comes into account, is that he did play on that Muslim card. He played on being a son of a bus driver to get votes, to then get elected and not actually do anything for that community he claimed to, that he was serving. That's where the problem comes.
For sure. I appreciate your time. Of course, this situation is ongoing, so we'll have to see how it develops. But we have reached the end of the show. But thank you very much, Baba, for appearing with us. And thank you to everyone at home. This is another edition of Ireland Islam that successfully come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of the show. But for now, assalamu alaikum.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Shares of U.S. banks extended recent losses, with regional banks hit hardest. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. CNBC noted the dramatic drop in regional bank stocks is a key entry point for investors, according to analyst Christopher Marinak. Marinak, who serves as director of research at Janney Montgomery Scott, believes the group's decline over the past week provides an entry point for investors because underlying business fundamentals remain intact. Marinak told CNBC's Fast Money recently, "We have definitely slipped on a banana peel as it pertains to this deposit worry and scare." The SPDR and S&P Regional Banking ETF dropped by more than 12% recently after regulators shuttered Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. They are the second and third largest banks' failures, respectively, in the United States of America's history. He added, the main lending in America's are still mid-size and small community banks. Those companies are plays. According to Reuters, some U.S. regional banks are under pressure after the collapse of two lenders within days, with industry executives and advisors saying they could be forced to seek saviors if a rout in their stocks doesn't let up. Also, the New York Times wrote this headline, "Bank shares tumble in wake of failures," adding, "The stocks of regional banks fell following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank as regulators tried to contain the damage." RT also noted stocks of U.S. regional lenders continued to slide as First Republic Bank recorded a massive drop of 61.8%, forcing a brief halt in trading due to volatility. The San Francisco-based lender extended last week's loss of 33%. The country's banking sector has been buffeted by a series of collapses that began last week. PacWest Bancorp slid 45%, while Western Alliance Bancorp lost more than 47%. Zion Bank Corporation declined by about 26%, while KeyCorp shed some 27%. Major financial institutions were also under pressure, with trading halted repeatedly due to volatility throughout the day. Charles Schwab, which had already lost 20%, tumbled more than 11% recently. Bank of America finished 5.8% lower, and the SPDR, S&P Regional Banking Exchange Traded Fund, fell 12%. The turmoil among U.S. bank stocks stems from the collapse of Silicon Valley after customers demanded their deposits and the company's stock plummeted amid worries over the bank's financial health. The tech and startup-focused bank was shut down by regulators shortly after California-based, crypto-focused Silvergate Bank announced its liquidation earlier last week. New York-based Signature Bank was shut down over the weekend due to concerns for the lender's liquidity. Recently, First Republic said it had received additional liquidity from the Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan Chase. The lender added that the injection raised its unused liquidity to $70 billion before any funding it could get from the Fed. First Republic's capital and liquidity positions are very strong, and its capital remains well above the regulatory threshold for well-capitalized banks, founder Jim Herbert and CEO Mike Ruffler said in a statement seen by CNBC. Recently, the U.S. Federal Reserve announced a new bank term funding program that will offer loans for up to a year to shore up confidence in the banking system and protect depositors of failing banks. Under the new scheme, both insured and uninsured depositors of the collapsed banks will get full access to their money through a special fund of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC. The regulator also eased the terms of banks' access to its discount window.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episodes, we have been talking about how to teach our children about love, to love people with all their goods and all their odds, whatever they have. And in the meantime, we also understood that it's also important to teach our children about the self-respect, about the idea that when they are expressing, when they are actually loving someone, we actually got to teach all these things through our upbringing, the way we behave with them. You said that we have to behave with them in the way that even when we are expressing a disagreement with them, it should be very respectful. You also shared one of the hadiths with us. I would want you to teach us more on the fact, like, for example, there are children who often, like, about their brothers or their sisters on the table, on the dining table, or anywhere in the room, like, whenever they are with their parents, they kind of try to say, she did this thing wrong, or I know you're wrong over here, I know you went wrong over here. So as they grow up, they try to be more like that. They try to be more that I am a kind of person who was right, and my sister or the brother, you need to correct yourself. So sometimes, yes, our brothers and sisters are at wrong place, but how do we say to them in a respectful manner?
So number one, we should try... as parents, as siblings, to talk to them separately, in seclusion from others, so that they do not feel offended or let down in front of others. So if there is something which needs to be pointed out, it has to be corrected, it should be done, not in front of the others. Of course, sometimes you need to do that in front of others to make your point, strike at the iron when it is hot.
All right.
You need to, hammer the nail in at a time when it is that thing is being done. So it has to be, you need to determine what situation is. Sometimes you have gone through the exercise of talking to them separately and trying to make them realize that they're making a mistake.
But you have failed all the time.
But then it comes. Then the only solution left is that now you need to, put them, tell them off in front of others, so they feel bad about it. They feel maybe offended by it, but they remember that that would be coming to us if we're not careful and if we're not mannerful. So the important thing is when we talk about, for example, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar. So it has levels and it has conditions and it has certain levels. You start off with lower levels at a milder ways, and then you go to levels which are a little harsher. So it's not that we completely reject being harsh, or we say that, we should always be mild. But the first thing is the attempt should be to, manage the situation in a way that it does not make them lose their self-pride and respect. And that is done by doing so in a very beautiful and polite manner. Even in front of others, you can make a...
Whenever the time you are actually trying to teach or guide, be that your siblings, be that your children, that they are wrong at some place, their self-respect has to be maintained. That is something that has not to be let get hurt. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the ways to actually guide a child to actually show his consent or show his disagreement towards a particular thing, maintaining the self-respect of the other party. Yes, Professor.
One of the important things is that you need to make your child or your sibling understand that whatever you're doing is based on what you feel inside. There has to be a coherence between your inner feelings and your outward expressions. What you feel and what you think, how you feel and think, should come outside also. People should realize that you're sincere. People should realize that you're truthful. What you want to say is what you are saying is out of the heart, and you really want, you love the person, and you want him to be a good person. Loving a person is thinking positively. Is thinking. Something should come about positively in the other person. You want him to be a better human being. That is your true love. The true love is the person realize that what you are saying is something you really feel for. It's not something just of a facade that you...
Exactly. Professor, just last night I was going through a video of a psychiatrist, and she was saying that when you want... nobody actually likes the feedback, and especially the negative feedback. And why people don't like that? Because they don't need validation from you. And but still, if you validate things like, hey, you are doing good, and then say, I would want you to be more better, rather than saying just fix a particular thing. So how much do you agree with this, that not to tell a person directly, hey, I want you to fix this, rather than telling this directly, telling that person at least, appreciating or encouraging his one or two qualities, and then telling that person to fix this and this quality within you?
Yes, of course. There are two aspects to this, in my humble opinion. One aspect is the person who wants to express his love by telling the person off, that you fix this. So the better thing would be, as you said, you should start off with appreciating and praising him.
Yeah.
Appreciation should be first of things, because everything is not negative about the other person. There must be some good aspects to it, to him or her. So you can start off by appreciating him, praising him for things that are good about him. And within that, you present something which is, you know, you need to rectify and correct.
Yeah.
That is one aspect,
all
certainly.
Right.
And through that, you are trying to...
show also sympathy and tell other person to fix a particular
sympathy,
problem.
Not just sympathy, you're showing empathy.
Yeah.
You want to make him feel that I feel for you.
All right.
And what you should be feeling for yourself, I'm also feeling like that.
All right.
So you need to empathize with the person in a way that he or she feels that you're really feeling for him. And and it's not, it's something for the betterment of not only myself, it's the betterment of my relationship with other human beings.
Professor,
other aspect is that the person who's being told off, he should be prepared for anything.
Yeah.
He should not feel bad about it. He should think of things in a positive way.
Yeah.
Even if the person who is telling him off is doing it in an offensive way, but he should try to, you know, reconcile with that, and he should try to justify that. Look, in any case, if he's telling me off, especially my parents, if one of my parents becomes angry or is used to, you know, scolding me and becoming angry, you should feel, you should say, look, at the end of the day, he or she wants a better future for me.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't be put off. I shouldn't be.
Exactly. Professor, we would want more explanation from you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakawi, and we are discussing about how can you actually teach your child to teach other people to fix particular things in them in a very respectful manner. Yes, Professor.
Yes, so as I was saying, basically we need to show our love, we should show our compassion, empathize with them. They should feel that we're truthful with them, we're honest with them, we're sincere with them. We love them, and that's why we're asking them to be good people.
But Professor, don't you think most of the times we ask people to fix things in them, they feel very disrespectful, or they feel like, definitely the opposite person is jealous with me, and that's why this person wants me to fix the things. How do we develop this
sometimes
ideology?
It's because it depends upon how we feel towards them.
All right.
I mean, sometimes we feel that the other's feelings towards us in the same way that we feel for them, in the same way we think for them. If we think positively about them, if we start to think positively about others, we will start thinking that they are also positive to us. If I feel jealous about the person, then I would say he also is
so
jealous.
So this is a vice versa process,
it's
kind of?
Yes, it is
a two-way
so
process.
If we want to change others also, we need to start from ourselves. And if we feel...
Charity begins at home.
Exactly. So we need to change our feelings. We need to make us ourselves realize that the other person is also a human being and we should respect him. And we should start loving him. Love means not forgetting yourself, but love means not forgetting others also.
All right.
I mean, yes, I'm not saying that we completely think of ourselves to be nothing. We lose everything. We lose our self-respect. No, we shouldn't feel so trampled down, but also we should not trample upon the other person. Our love for the other person, it should not be because of greed. Our love for some person should not be because I like him. No, because it's because he is a human being and I need to love him as a human being. So it should be based
on... It's a creation of Allah,
exactly.
And I got to be respecting
so the way I feel about him, I feel that he feels the same way. So even if someone comes with a positive attitude towards me, because I have a negative attitude, I think that he also has a negative attitude. And that is one of the problems which we face normally in society or at places of work. We do not accept the other person because we are not accepting. We feel that he doesn't accept us.
All right. So it's just somewhere deep down, us realize the problem. It's a two-way process. We'll discuss more on this in the upcoming episodes. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. Dear listeners, Imam Ali Alayhi Salam said, if you want to tell someone, fix a particular thing, tell him all alone, because that way you have actually taken him to a higher level and actually conveyed your thing. But if you're telling him in public, you have actually got him deep down and you have actually disregarded him, you have actually disrespected that person. So we got to be taking care of all these things. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Nowruz is the message of peace and friendship by the Iranians for the whole world. Happy Nowruz!
In Nowruz, stay with IRIB English Radio to get familiar with Iranian traditions. Happy New Iranian Calendar Year. Happy Nowruz. In the limelight.
The director of U.S. Air National Guard has claimed personnel from the U.S. and Ukraine have been just a phone call away during the conflict. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has said that discussions about the delivery of fighter jets to Kyiv once again underline the growing involvement of Western regimes in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. He reiterated Moscow's stance that such actions only serve to escalate and prolong the fighting and would lead to more bloodshed while failing to change the ultimate outcome of Russia's military operation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, American pilots have remained in constant contact with their Ukrainian counterparts during the crisis with Russia, advising on operational tactics and how to use U.S.-made weapons, Director of the U.S. Air National Guard, Lieutenant General Michael Lowe, has said. Air-launched weapons supplied by Washington to Kyiv come with permanent U.S. support. Lowe reminded journalists at the Air and Space Forces Association Symposium in Colorado recently. The Americans initially explained to Ukrainian airmen what you need to do to survive the initial attack, with cooperation later expanding to, here's how you can continue to deliver air power, Lowe explained in comments cited recently by Business Insider. Most of this consulting has been provided through the California National Guard, which has been cooperating with Ukraine since the early 1990s as part of the National Guard's State Partnership Program, according to the report. This has reportedly allowed a Ukrainian soldier to pick up the phone to say, hey, I'm having a problem with this weapon system, to somebody who actually trained them and solve a problem on the ground, the general pointed out. Among other things, the U.S. general said the U.S. pilots have been advising the Ukrainians on how to conduct combat in line with the U.S. Air Force's concept for dispersed operations and on how to use U.S.-made weapons, including AGM-88 anti-radiation missiles and JDAM's guidance kits, which allow bombs to go farther. We are continuing to provide them the tactics, techniques, and procedures for things like agile combat employment and new weapon systems, Lowe said, as cited by Business Insider, adding that these consultations have continued over this last 13 months of conflict. While it has sent missiles and other weaponry to Ukraine, the U.S. regime has so far been reluctant to heed Kyiv's call to provide it with F-16 fighter jets. However, NBC reported earlier this month that at least two Ukrainian pilots have been training on simulators at a military base in Arizona to establish how long it will take to train them to fly Western fighter jets. Russia has long decried deliveries of weapons to Ukraine by the U.S. regime and its allies.
arguing that these only serve to escalate and prolong the fighting, while also failing to change the ultimate outcome of the Russian operation. According to Moscow, arms deliveries, intelligence sharing and training provided to Kiev's troops and other forms of assistance have already made Western nations de facto parties to the conflict. NBC had earlier reported that the U.S. has invited Ukrainian pilots to a military base in Tucson, Arizona, to establish how long it will take to train them to fly Western fighter jets, including F-16s. Unnamed officials told NBC. Two airmen from Ukraine have arrived on American soil so far, with more likely to follow, the broadcaster reported recently. According to its sources, the U.S. authorities plan to bring as many as 10 Ukrainian aviators to the country this month. The pilots have been working on simulators and there are no plans for them to fly actual aircraft, the officials noted. The program has two goals: improving the Ukrainians' skills and assessing how long it will take to train them to effectively operate F-16s and other Western-made warplanes, they added. A Biden administration official claimed the program is about assessing their abilities as pilots so we can better advise them on how to use capabilities they have and we have given them. It's the first time that Ukrainian pilots who have been trained to fly Soviet-designed aircraft that differ significantly from their Western counterparts have taken part in such a program in the U.S., NBC pointed out. The officials who talked to the broadcaster stressed that the development did not mean there had been any change in Washington's stance on the delivery of F-16s to Kiev amid its conflict with Moscow. "I'm ruling it out for now," U.S. President Joe Biden claimed last week when asked about the possibility of arming Ukraine with American fighter jets. Ukrainian leader Zelensky doesn't need F-16s now. There is no basis upon which there is a rationale, according to our military, now to provide F-16s, Biden told ABC News. Kiev has intensified calls for NATO to supply it with fighter jets, particularly F-16 aircraft, in recent months after securing a pledge from EU countries, the US and UK, to provide dozens of Leopard 2, M1 Abrams and Challenger 2 main battle tanks, respectively. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has said discussions about the delivery of fighter jets to Kiev once again underline the growing involvement of Western regimes in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. He reiterated Moscow's stance that such actions only serve to escalate and prolong the fighting and would lead to more bloodshed while failing to change the ultimate outcome of Russia's operation.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The
United States has suffered is some of its biggest bank failures since 2008. Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the U.S., failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. Officials say they acted to protect insured depositors. Regulators have taken control of the lender's deposits and transferred the assets to a newly created entity. Nearly half of the American technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. Moreover, a large number of startups will not be able to make payroll at some point in the next month if they cannot access their money. The lender had been under pressure lately due to fears of recession, higher interest rates, and a slowdown in the market for initial public offerings. The factors had made it harder for startups to raise additional cash. But Silicon Valley Bank was not the only U.S. financial institution to fail. Following the collapse of SVB, customers withdrew more than $10 billion U.S. dollars in deposits from New York-based Signature Bank. Regulators have now said that Signature was taken over to protect its depositors and the stability of the U.S. financial system. Signature had 40 branches, assets of $110.36 billion U.S. dollars, and deposits of $88.59 billion U.S. dollars at the end of 2022. Signature Bank was founded in 2001 as a more business-friendly alternative to the big banks. It expanded to the West Coast and then opened itself to the crypto industry in 2018.
Signature Bank is a business mostly bank with actually pretty good deposits relative to lending. And it closed mainly because I think the same thing we're seeing across the banking industry, sort of a psychology of investors losing faith in the credit quality of banking in general.
And there are a lot of red flags here. That's certainly one of them, the concentration in one industry. The explosive growth over the last year, they literally doubled in size from 100 some odd billion to over 200 billion in assets, catapulting them into one of the largest size echelon of banks in the US. They also had a very, as they say in the banking world and accounting, they had a very mismatched portfolio.
The bank failures have sparked fears of contagion in the financial sector, not only in the United States, but also in other countries. Bank shares in the US, Asia, and Europe have slumped following the collapse of SVB and Signature Bank. Investors have started to worry about the general state of the banking sector. Smaller US lenders were particularly hard hit. Investors are concerned that the failures are a sign of troubles at other firms. Several pension funds in the US and at least two overseas have lost millions of dollars due to the crisis. Institutions such as the California Public Employees Retirement Fund, the California State Teachers Retirement System, Korea's National Pension Service, and Sweden's Elective Pension Fund had reportedly invested in SVB. Analysts believe Silicon Valley Bank's collapse is likely to be felt across the technology landscape globally over the coming years.
But, you know, you also have the question of the impact on the financial technology and research and development, venture capital industries in the United States. There's $160 billion potentially tied up in this receivership that the venture capital industry could lose.
Governments in the United Kingdom and the United States have taken extraordinary steps to stop a potential banking crisis. The UK Treasury and the Bank of England have announced that they had facilitated the sale of SVB UK to HSBC, Europe's biggest bank, ensuring the security of £6.7 billion of deposits. President Biden has also pledged stiffer bank regulations, forcing regulators to step in with a series of emergency measures.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The crisis has underscored the risks to banks from the end of easy money. Global borrowing costs have risen as the Federal Reserve lifted U.S. rates by 450 basis points from near zero. The European Central Bank hiked the Eurozone's by 300. There are concerns that price inflation will stay high, something that would drive further rate hikes.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia have risen to unprecedented levels after Washington accused Moscow of colliding with one of its Reaper surveillance drones, forcing it to crash into the Black Sea waters off Crimea. Russia denied it deliberately brought the unmanned aerial vehicle down. Moscow says the drone went down after stalling and never came into contact with another aircraft. Russia says the UAV was flying towards the Russian border without an active transponder in clear violation of the restricted area established for the conduct of the special military operation. Two interceptors were dispatched to investigate. As a result of sharp maneuvers, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle went into uncontrolled flight, lost altitude, and collided with the water surface. The Russian fighters did not use weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home base. That's what the Russian Defense Ministry stated. But the U.S. has rejected Russia's explanation, accusing Russian jets of an unsafe and unprofessional intercept of the drone. U.S. military officials claimed their spy drone was operating in international airspace when a pair of Su-27 jets appeared, sprayed it with fuel, and struck the propeller of the UAV, which caused it to crash into the sea.
But there is a pattern of behavior recently where there is a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. And it wasn't just involving us. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has already reached out to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, to discuss the incidents. The last time Shoigu and Austin spoke was in October 2022. The latest incident has further strained the already tense relations between the two nations.
I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart, Minister Shoigu. As I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication. And the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows. And it is incumbent upon Russia to operate its military aircraft in a safe and professional manner.
The Kremlin said on Wednesday that relations with the U.S. were in a lamentable state and at their lowest level. Calls are already growing loud in the U.S. to retaliate against Russia. Hawkish Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested opening fire on Russian fighter jets that intercept U.S. drones.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets.
Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the senator's call to shoot down Russian aircraft went far beyond common sense and risked all-out war between the world's largest nuclear powers. Since Russia started the military operation in eastern Ukraine, contact between American and Russian military leaders has been limited. Meanwhile, Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has said that the drone crash represents a moment of great tension in relations between Moscow and Washington. He also urged the West and Russia to exercise caution so that they could avoid a direct clash. The crisis comes as the war is still raging on in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russian forces must be stopped in Bakhmut and other towns in the east. Russia has said the capturing of Bakhmut opens a path to taking control of the entire Donetsk region, one of its central war aims.
Wagner PMC units have practically surrounded Bakhmut. Only one road is left open to Ukrainian forces. The pincers are getting tighter. If earlier the professional Ukrainian army fought with us, today we see more and more old people and children.
Russian forces and fighters from Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut's east, but have apparently failed to encircle the city. NATO also warned last week that Bakhmut could fall within a matter of days.
G20
China's President Xi Jinping has pledged to bolster the country's security and build the military into a great wall of steel to defend Beijing's interests.
So as to guarantee a new development pattern through a new security architecture, we should further advance our mobilization drive in terms of national defense and military, and to turn China's military into a great wall of steel that will effectively defend the country's sovereignty, security, and development interests.
He also stressed the need for an improved national security system as well as an improved social governance system.